Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is November 1st, 2021. It is a somewhat overcast day here in Nashville. The temperature is predicted to get to 65, and so it will be a nice day for some outdoor activities. Thanks, as always, to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our bluesy intro music. While I am headquartered here in Nashville, I do strive to bring programs of general interest that are not just focused on Nashville. But one subject that keeps returning is the goings-on at Nashville's famous Warner Parks. And if you explore the archives of the podcast, you will find at least three previous programs that touch on the Warner Parks. They have been among our most popular program offerings. And so when the publishing of a new book on the history of the Warner Parks was announced, it seemed only natural, well, almost obligatory, to do a program about this new book, especially when the author-editor is an old friend. And so our guest today is Lynn Baklita. Lynn is a Nashville-based writer who was engaged by the Friends of Warner Parks organization to develop this wonderful new book, which is a rich collection of original writing by Lynn and excellent contributions by more than a dozen individuals, which take us along a timeline from the beginnings of the park until present day. This is a hardback book with abundant illustrations and historical pictures, and it would make a wonderful Christmas present for anyone who has an interest in Nashville and the outdoors. And all of this for the benefit of the Friends of Warner Parks organization. Thank you to Lynn for making herself available for this interview. And we will get started with Lynn right after these brief words.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, editor-in-chief of the Tennessee Conservationist magazine. Every year, we publish six beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Lynn Baklita, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Well, hello, Mark. It's so nice after all these years that we've known each other to be doing this.
It's really fun. Lynn, I was trying to think about, you know, when we first got to know each other, and I know it has something to do with maybe a yoga class or perhaps Susan Knowles. We have many mutual friends have had over the years. And I can remember running into you at the, if it's running is the right word to use, connecting with you at the swimming pool at Westside Athletic Club and suggesting that you do a yoga class. And then you started doing yoga and you got hooked on that. We both were hooked on it, certainly.
We were.
But we've been Saturday connected morning. For a good long time, haven't we?
We have. The first time I think I actually met you somehow was in your capacity at the state with, what was your title with Parks?
Well, I was director, assistant commissioner.
Okay, yeah, that. Yeah. Because I remember sitting in your office and the woman who was your boss, you were talking about cell phone towers, which were a new problem at the time. And she said, think about how we could camouflage them, Mark, because they're not going away. They're here to stay. And I thought,
well, that was way before I was director. And the only person that could possibly have been Kay Barnett.
That sounds about right.
And she's lasted in the department for about a year, perhaps. And that's probably a good illustration of why she lasted only a year. uh, they They were trying to put some cell phone towers out near Radnor Lake, as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they
yeah,
were.
That's right. And there are some out there, but the placement of them was negotiated a good bit.
Well, yeah, because they're terrible for migratory birds.
Well, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's great to see you. Lynn, we're here today to talk about your new book, A History of Warner Park. Warner Parks, I should say, plural. And this is brand new, out on the shelves as of the 1st of November, I think. Is that right?
True.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful hardback book and filled with tremendously interesting content. And I want to talk about that in detail with you. But as we do in each episode of this podcast is when we talk to people who share our interest in conservation and the environment and the out of doors, I like to pry a little bit into their background and into how, as a matter of their development, they got interested in that and tell us a little bit about your story in that regard.
Well, I think it has to be tied to the fact that I was an only child. So growing up on Battery Lane here in Nashville and then in Brentwood on Franklin Pike Circle before Brentwood was the Brentwood
that it is
we have today.
Sure. Yeah.
I was just outside a lot. I mean, I didn't want to be in and I didn't have any siblings to stay in and play board games with necessarily. So I was just always outside and I think that served me really, really well.
And you have used that interest to, as part of your writing of several different books over the years. I remember one of the first that I, of your books that I have and read was was it called Dangerous Out of Door?
Dangerous Wildlife was a regional series for Menasha Ridge Press, and I did the Southeast, the Mid-Atlantic, California, and those were published. And then the manuscript forms for the Southwest, which was definitely the fattest book for Dangerous Wildlife. But the Southeast comes right behind it.
That's fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And when I was approached to do the book, I thought, oh, this is useful information. I would really like to know what I need to be aware of. So it really dovetailed with my own interest.
Are those books still available?
I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I should answer my own question. I think you can probably get them in the secondary market out there at Amazon.
Yeah, you probably can.
Not likely that they're still in print, so to speak. Because they've been, what has it been? 20 years ago.
Close to that.
Yeah.
And honestly, for us, Dangerous Wildlife in the Southeast is a terrifically practical book because it's not only the critters that in the flora and fauna that you should be aware of, but it's first aid stuff and you know, just how do you respond and how can you actually avoid rattlesnakes, for example, rather than, oh, what do you do? Oh, my God, it's a rattlesnake. Oh, right. It bit me. Oh, where's the book? Oh.
things to do before there's a crisis. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. All right.
Yeah.
Now, you have also written some guidebooks. There's one of a guidebook of the Natchez Trace, I believe.
Yes, and that served me very well. In relation to a history of Nashville's Warner Parks, because part of the trace goes through the Warner Parks.
That's fun. Well, let's talk about the Warner Park book. How did this come to be? There credit given to Eleanor Willis in the book.
Absolutely.
And I know Eleanor. But how did it come to be? Tell us that story.
Well, Eleanor was the executive director of the Friends of Warner Park, and I think it was 8 or 9 years ago that she retired. And immediately she started raising money, private money, for this book. She was determined. So she raised all the money for it and kept the faith, because it had another writer assigned to it who became overwhelmed and had to back out of the project. And then God bless Ann Roberts, who's a friend of Eleanor's, and Ann said, well, have you thought about Lynn Bockleda? And Eleanor said, well, no, let me call her. And so I got this phone call out of the blue, and she said, this is Eleanor Willis. And I said, oh, hello. We knew each other a little bit. She said, would you have any interest in writing a book about the Warner Parks? And I remember saying, yes.
Tell us more. You say there had been a previous person working on it, but had they left you any materials, or did you just start whole cloth?
Excuse me. I don't mean to be mysterious. It was Christine Kraling.
Oh, okay.
Who would have been a wonderful fit for this book.
Now, Christine, for those that may not know, is a writer of high regard here in Nashville, has written for the Nashville Scene for years on the subject of urban design and historic preservation.
Yes.
Also a graduate of the University of Cincinnati, as I recall.
Yay.
Yay. Go Bearcats.
Go Bearcats. So Christine said, yes, I'd love to do it. But she got overwhelmed with, I don't know, it might have been The Plan of Nashville or some other books that became, as this one did for me, much bigger projects than she had envisioned.
I got it.
And so she let go of the project. But I'm very happy to say that we have two chapters written by her. And I want to take this opportunity to make clear that I am the editor of the book, and I did write quite a few of the chapters.
Right.
However, there are 16 of us.
Right.
That it took to actually pull this off. And I mean, I joke and say, you know, it took so long, two of the people are dead. Now, that's a tasteless joke.
Right.
But in fact, they were dead decades before the book was started.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. One was Crom Tidwell on the Iroquois steeplechase, and then Louise Davis, who used to write for the Tennessean. I found a lovely piece that she did, and I just had to include it.
Tell us about that piece.
The Louise Davis piece, you know, some of it was born of, when you're doing a book like this, it's organized by decades, and you look at what you've got, and I thought, oh my God, there's nothing much in the 60s. And the reason for that is that the parks enjoyed enormous popularity from the get-go. And by the 60s, the late 60s, the parks were pretty abused, but Louise wrote this piece dated 1960, and it's just idyllic. It's very poetic and yet down to earth about how people used the park on any given Sunday, of people picnicking, families that picnicked under a different tree every Sunday, and archers shooting through this glade. And I do wish that we still had an archery range there. That sounds like it would have been a whole lot of fun. And, you know, little boys playing Daniel Boone, swinging through the vines. I mean, it's just a beautiful short piece that not only helped me fill the hole for the 1960s in the book, but gave a really clear sense of how Nashvillians were using the park.
So much fun. Well, let's go back and let's talk about the early foundation of the park, and maybe it would serve our listeners a little bit to talk a little bit about what the Warner Parks are. just generally. I mean, there may be people that don't know.
Well, the Warner Parks presently are an astonishing 3,200 acres. In obviously what is now quite an urban setting. So they really stand out. They're not the largest parks in the United States, just in terms of acreage, but they're right up there, and they really are astonishing given their location and what has grown up around them. The thing that I did not know about the parks, and Eleanor, to her credit, said, I want you to tell the story, warts and all. And I don't know if this is a wart or not, but the parks were really contested. The development, it was not popular with everyone, particularly the people that lived in what I would call the Harpeth Valley. There were family farmsteads there that went back to the late 1700s. So the Percy Warner was the first park to open in 1927. So you have family farms there that have been in the family for more than 100 years for some people. And the idea of, nope, you got to leave, we're going to make it a park. Now, it just didn't sit well with everyone. Some people were happy to be bought out, but some were not. And we were just speaking about Johnson Vaughn,
right,
whose father gave... The reason why we have Vaughn's Creek, Vaughn's Road, Vaughn's Gap, it's his dad.
In West Nashville, right.
Yes.
Right.
And Johnson Vaughn, his son, I'm sorry, I'm screwing this up. Johnson Vaughn was the elder.
Right.
John William Vaughn was the son who went by the name Squire, which almost tells you everything you need to know. I've found this amazing picture of him that is the epitome of squirishness, if there is such a thing. But he was determined, John William Vaughn was determined not to leave. And he fought the Parks Board all the way to the Tennessee State Supreme Court, where he lost.
Right.
So they used eminent domain, but he struck a bargain with them that said, well, and he said, well, just let me live here. I think it was until 1930, maybe, or 31. And I won't plant anything, you know, so I know you want to turn this from cropland, which it broadly was. And we're talking about the area in particular where the Steeplechase is now and the Harpeth Hills Golf Course. he said, just, you know, let me live here and I'll pay you a low rent. And so they said, okay. And he actually died before the term of that agreement was up. So
interesting.
He won because he got to live in his childhood home and was carried out feet first instead of leaving like so many of the other families did.
But so that, interesting. That was, you know, that this is imagine a park board having that sort of of authority, and of course this is before metropolitan government by a long, long way.
Oh yes.
And so these areas were, if not outside the city's boundaries, very, very much. I mean, they were right on the edge of the county.
Well, you've hit on an important point there because the city passed an ordinance, which I guess, I don't know if it was tested in court, but they said, the city said, even 10 miles beyond the established city boundary, we can bring eminent domain into play. Which is, which you could either look at it as farsighted or a real unethical land grab. And that's sort of, in part, a kernel of the Warner Parks stories, because, and this was interesting to me because I'm a playwright, and so you always look for conflict. And I thought, well, okay, I mean, I love the parks, but I don't know that there's a great story there. And there actually is, because it was not simple to carve out the original lands. And then the lands that have been subsequently added, the Friends of Warner Parks has, I don't even want to think about what those parks would be like without the, I think it's now over $7 million that the Friends have raised since, I think, 86, that enabled them to buy the additional lands to expand it, because, you know, they're not making land next to the parks anymore. So when some comes up, they've been very aggressive in getting that land.
Well, that's right, and some of those purchases have been rather recent and comparatively.
Yes.
The Hill property, I know that you're making reference to.
And the Birch Reserve.
And the Birch property, exactly. Two immensely important properties from a biological heritage sort of standpoint.
Yes. Yeah. The Hill Forest has old growth on it, and that it's called the Hill property because our former grocer, H.G. Hill, bought that land, and it's fronts along Highway 70. He bought it as a place where he wanted to live, and he took his wife out there and said, "What do you think?" And she said, "I'm not living way the hell out here. Nobody's going to come see us." Now, way the hell out here is now before the intersection of Highway 70 and Old Hickory Boulevard, 9 miles from downtown.
I was going to say, I was going to guess 15, but it's
no.
I see it's 9. Okay.
It's really right. Almost exactly at 9 Mile Hill.
Right.
And but he continued to farm the land and loved it. And when loggers came through, which I think was in the early 20s, I'm not positive about that, he said, "No, you can't log on this land." And he fenced around the old growth trees so that his cows would not damage them. So we have the H.G. Hill family, really, right, to thank for a quite an astonishing gift. It was purchased, but they didn't have to sell to the parks.
Do you know, the last time I looked into that, tours of that property had to be prearranged, and you had to have a host to go back there with you. Is that still the case?
It is, because invasive species are a huge threat for the Warner Parks, and they are really concentrating. They have a two-prong effort right now. The Hill Forest, they are trying to just keep, it's in pretty good shape, and they're trying to keep the invasives out. So
right.
Invasive Species Control, which is a company, Steve Manning is one of the principals, and he used to work at the parks really as a young man, and got interested enough to move into this professionally. They don't let people on because they don't want them bringing invasives with them unknowingly. Now,
right,
that sounds kind of crazy. It's not like, you know, somebody's going to sneak in there and plant a Japanese honeysuckle bush. But what you can carry on your shoes and your clothing and be completely unaware,
sure,
can, in fact, turn out to be quite damaging for the
park. You can arrange to get a tour if you,
yes,
pay attention at the Nature Center there. They do have times when they will take people back, and it's definitely worthwhile. There's some huge beech trees back there, and
yes,
other And of course, when you see those in the forest, they're the sign of old growth.
Right.
That you're in an old growth situation.
And just as a point of interest, beech trees are the most common species of tree in the Warner Parks.
Right.
And the other effort toward invasive species management, the Friends currently are undertaking another massive fundraising effort called It's My Nature. And one of the thrusts of that is to rid the park of the invasive species, which when I heard that, I thought, well, that's a nice idea, but it's a fool's errand. And I was wrong. They are doing it. And the proof of that is easy to see in two places. The entrance to the Warner Parks off Belmead Boulevard, up the LA steps, on either side, you can really tell a difference that all of that undergrowth from the Japanese honeysuckle is gone. And also on Old Hickory, as you're passing, heading east and passing over the crest of the hill toward the steeplechase, if you look to your left, and you'll see that the understory is all cleared out, and it's really making a difference. And they're going for it. They're aiming to have the park's invasive species free, because otherwise, if they're left unchecked, you won't have a Warner Parks that you even recognize.
Well, thank you, Lynn. You know, invasive species and their control has been a repeated theme of this podcast.
I would think so.
Jenny Hannon was a guest of mine on this program, I guess maybe 18 months ago, 2 years ago, and when they started talking about that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And as you indicated, I'm like, well, that may be a pipe dream, but it seems to me they are making real progress.
They are.
And
I
would point out to those that may be skeptics that many years ago, 25 years ago, a similar situation was happening at Radnor Lake with privet hedge and honeysuckle mm-hmm. predominating. And they have virtually eliminated it there. It's not all the way gone, but man, is it, it's so much gone that they're starting to see native wildflowers that they hadn't seen in years. And
yes.
So this can happen at Warner Parks. They're going to have to keep their eye on the ball. Let's jump back to the early development of the park.
Okay.
And I think about parks and their development quite a bit. But, you know, it's interesting to me that Warner Parks and several of the key Nashville parks predate our state park system.
Mm-hmm.
The state park system really became functional in 36 and 37. And so here we have a major park developed by a municipality, I guess with the assistance of the federal government to some degree, but predating the state park system by, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Yes, this is another interesting story. The initial gift to the city of 868 acres was made by Colonel Luke Lee. And I say Colonel because that was a title that he loved, because he was in World War I. He was a colonel with some success, definitely. And it's not a hidden fact at all, but Percy Warner was Luke Lee's father-in-law. And Percy Warner was head of the parks board. And his idea, and God, if he had only lived, he wanted to ring the perimeter of Nashville with major parks on the scale, hopefully, of the Warner Parks. and they would be connected by a ring road, which would have given the city a completely different feel and identity nationally and locally. So Percy Warner, in addition to being head of the Parks and Recs Board, was head of Nashville Light and Rail, which meant he was the utilities guy. Luke Lee, who was a forward-thinking person of a magnitude that you rarely see, when Bellmead Plantation collapsed in the early 1900s, Luke Lee and a couple of other guys were all over that to buy the land, which they did. Luke Lee wanted to do a residential development out of that land, which became Bellmead. So he had excellent instincts. Bellmead was slow to take off as a subdivision, interestingly, for as desirable as it is now. So Luke Lee talks to his father-in-law, Percy Warner, and says, "Hey, I want to do this development. How about if you extend the streetcar spur that goes out West End and you take it down Bellmead Boulevard, which I'm going to make, and I'll guarantee you riders, because my development is going to be right there, and you in turn will provide transportation for my guys to get into the city to their jobs, and I will donate 868 acres for a park to be an amenity for the subdivision." And so Percy Warner, who was a big outdoors person and such an interesting person, I mean, he had a pet crane named Rufus, who he did, I don't want to say tricks, but they had a deep relationship, he and Rufus did.
Now, there's a picture in the book.
I had to put that one in.
I love it.
Yeah.
Never knew about that.
It shows you he was kind of a quirky guy. So anyway, it was a hand in glove arrangement. There was nothing illegal.
This is public whatsoever. And private partnership.
Exactly.
They're head of their time by a couple of generations.
And the 868 acres that Luke Lee bought was known mostly as what was then called the High Pasture as a part of Bellmead. And now it's pretty much the front door of what we think of as the parks, the Bellmead Boulevard, which, by the way, is a divided road because the streetcar ran down the median in the middle. Mm-hmm. The original gift goes kind of over that first set of hills that you see from Bellmead and then falls away on the backside to a service road that's almost directly across from Harpeth Trace development on Highway 100.
Got it.
And the people in the valley that I have referenced before were a little bit bitter about Luke Lee's gift because they felt like he was getting all of this credit for making this big magnanimous gesture. And they said, "This is hilly scrubland. You can't do anything with it. You can't farm it." But yet he's getting all these accolades for doing this. Well, it's true. You can't farm it, but for a park where you can hike it, bike it, horseback ride it, it's outstanding.
Right.
As we know. So we have the 868 acres, and immediately the park board said, "We're going to get more land." And so the acquisition of land to enhance the original gift began immediately after Luke's gift. I mean, they just hit the ground running with that. And so in 1927... again, to your point, before the state park system kicks in, what is then what became called Percy Warner Park opened. Now, it didn't have a name when it opened. Tragically, Percy Warner died, I think it was within 6 months. Okay. He died of a heart attack quite suddenly after the park was opened. And Luke Lee said, we should call it Percy Warner Park.
Oh, my.
And his wife said, no, we shouldn't. No one will ever remember that you gave the original land. He said, no, we're doing it. This is what I want. And, of course, the park board honored his wishes because
so cool.
Percy Warner was an extremely beloved character.
Right.
The tributes of the guys that worked the streetcars, the tributes in the newspaper were so touching of what kind of a human being Percy Warner was. So Edwin Warner, who was Percy's younger brother by 18 years younger, he steps into the gap that his brother has left due to his brother's death, gets on the parks board, becomes the chairman, and addresses the whole park system for improvements. But the truth is, you know, Warner Park was his little baby in a certain way of speaking. And so Edwin was extremely instrumental in additional parkland acquisition and gave 20,000 dollars, not a small piece of change.
No.
In like 1930, let's say, to buy additional land. So the three men are it's interesting because they were, as I say in the book, they were related by blood, by law, as in-laws, by aim and affection. And they were all three great outdoorsmen.
Lynn, how much of the park is on, or, I mean, all of it's eligible for the National Register of Historic Places, but are there districts in the park that are already on the National Register?
The parks as a whole are on the register.
Okay, all right.
The parks really, in my estimation, hit the jackpot in the 70s when you had a retired biology professor from Vanderbilt named Charles Farrell, who came on board. Bob Parrish, who eventually became superintendent of the Warner Parks. Sandy Bivens, who became director of the Nature Center. And Deb Beasley, who was assistant director of the Nature Center. Those four people, and they call themselves the Four Musketeers,
right,
moved the park forward in astonishing and cohesive ways. Bob Parrish is why it's on the National Register,
right,
of Historic Places.
Right. Right.
Charles Farrell gave a legacy of extensive and serious scientific research for the parks, which is something I had no clue about. Sandy Bivens, with her expertise for the Nature Center, and especially, the bird banding program there. And Deb Beasley, pretty much, as best I can tell, she kind of did everything in addition to all those miles of trail. She was the one dragging the equipment in with a couple of volunteers and keeping those things in those trails in good shape.
I can remember when that National Register nomination was being discussed, and you know, you always talk about what are the elements of the park that make it qualify it for such a designation, and of course the heavy association with the Roosevelt administration programs, WPA.
Absolutely,
et cetera, and the architectural merit in the roads and some of the structures there, were featured in the nomination, as I recall.
Absolutely, they were, and it's hard to over appreciate the impact that the WPA had on the parks. Basically, without the WPA contribution, it would have just been unenhanced land. They cut trails, they built the steeplechase, they built the picnic shelters, they built the rock retaining walls, they built the bridges. It's again, another thing that I was flabbergasted by, that the WPA built those parks.
Well, I guess it's the only publicly funded steeplechase course in maybe in the world, but certainly in the U.S.
Yes, certainly in the U.S. And it was controversial because, you know, it was a federal program and it was perceived as, well, what's the federal government doing paying for a place for rich people to exercise their horses?
Exactly.
And that's, there's some good truth to that.
That's a good question, yeah.
It is a good question. Yeah. Now, the equestrian program at the Warner Parks is much more broadly used than just whatever your perception is of the steeplechase crowd once a year. And so another equestrian chapter, an important chapter in the park, is one that was provided by a little tiny lady named Margaret Lindsley Warden. She wrote a column for the Tennessean for decades, and her specialty was developing equestrian programs in Middle Tennessee for young riders. And the Warner Parks were basically her home for doing that. And so she got Olympic trials there and many Goodness. Other firsts that also helped to put the Warner Parks and the steeplechase on the map.
Yeah, and the horse trails are available for public riding. I mean, if you have a horse or access to a horse, you can trailer them out there and
you absolutely
and
can
have access to the trails,
and it's free for parties of I think 10 and under riders. And the park used to have a stable, but some would say sadly that it doesn't have that anymore. It was one of those things; it was too dilapidated, and the Parks Board, as yet, has not. It's not a priority to rebuild it and have that as an amenity.
Right. Lynn, we need to wrap this up, and I the time goes very quickly, but I would be remiss and not talking about Laura Knox and
and
the sweet interview that you did with her that's in the book. Of course, she is the daughter of Luke Lee.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
She's Luke Lee's daughter, and she jokes and says she was born in 1927, and she jokes and says, well, you know, my father gave the original land in honor of my birth. And she laughs and says, and there is not a word of truth to that. But nonetheless, Laura really kind of grew up in the Warner Parks. She and her family picnicked there religiously. She said, there's not a tree on Percy Warner golf course that I haven't hit with my golf ball. She was a rider in the parks, but she said, I didn't have it. I didn't have the right stuff to be an equestrian. And she now lives at Harpeth Trace, so out her back door is the hill forest, and out her front door, 600 yards actually down the hill, you run into the Vaughn's Creek steeplechase course, which is another diverse use of the park. So Laura She had to be in the book because she's the only living first person, so to speak, tied to Luke Lee. And she's a real testament to the joy that Parks can give to people for their entire lives. She still goes to the park as much as she's able and enjoys it immensely.
You know, I have to say that she's one of the people, the very first people I met when I moved to Nashville in 1979, and still is one of those memorable characters. We do get to see her from time to time, and she always has a great story to tell.
Yes, and she's the epitome of Southern grace.
Exactly.
It still lives with Laura very, very much.
Well, Lynn, you've been a dear to spend this time with us today.
Well, it went like a breeze.
Well, I hope we have given people just a little bitty taste of what's in this book. And I will tell you that it has been a little taste because there's so much more to learn about the Warner Parks that Lynn has documented with her various contributors in this new book. And so I commend it to you to get out to Parnassus Bookstore or wherever you buy books locally, or if you are in California or New York or Ohio listening to this program, get on Amazon and look for A History of Nashville's Warner Parks. Lynn Buckley, editor.
Let me jump in one more because Jenny Hannon would definitely want me to say the Friends of Warner Parks, their website.
Ah, yes. Good. Thank you.
You can buy it through that. I'm pretty sure if you're just in the Warner Parks and stop into the Nature Center, they can sell you a copy over the counter.
Oh, okay. Good.
You buy it, a portion of the proceeds goes to the Friends of Warner Parks. None of the writers, all of that, you know, I don't make anything off of it at this point. And I will say that if you buy it through the Friends website or over the counter, the Friends get more money than they do from Parnassus. Okay. However, we're very grateful to Parnassus for carrying
it. Of course. Well, thank you, Lynn, for spending some time with us today. And encourage people to get out there and enjoy this new book.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Hold on just one second here.